Faith is almost or often misunderstood. I think sometimes what we think is that faith is saying to God, I'm going to tell you what I want you to give me and I'll have patience until you do. That's not faith. Faith is saying to God, I know that you're smarter than I am, and when my will and your will are not commensurate, not the same, I'm going to do what your will is because I know that you're always right. That's faith. And I don't know where the principle of faith is more applicable than in reference to our marriages. I want you to consider that marriage is a triangle. Truth is that all of our relationships as Christians are triangles. But I want you to think about it in reference to your marriage. It's not just a straight line between my spouse and me. We mustn't think like that. We've got to get out of that thinking because we'll never have success in marriage that way. It's a triangle. It's you and your spouse and God. And one of the things on which you and I will ultimately be judged is the kind of husband or wife we were. Christians don't commit adultery because they mean to. They commit adultery sometimes because they don't mean not to badly enough. Adultery that is a nuclear bomb in marriage occurs because of little compromises, of small compromises. And that's what I want you to appreciate. Right now, in the marriage counseling that I'm doing, I believe there are four, perhaps five couples in different places in the country with whom I'm having discussions, all of whom have marriages that have been dislodged in a dramatic way by an affair. All of them are Christian marriages. All of them are cases where husband and wife are both members of the church. The details are dramatically different, of course, about why this happened, how this could happen. But what I want you to hear as we begin this discussion of how to affair-proof your marriage, in every case, it didn't happen just suddenly in some old seedy hotel somewhere. It happened because of incremental compromises. I had a friend, a close friend, a few years ago, preacher, who in a different congregation, different state from mine, but I knew him when we were younger, good friends, and he was discovered in an affair that had lasted a few months with the preacher's wife in another congregation of the Church of Christ. And when I finally met up with him, and when this came out, of course, his world exploded. He lost his influence, he lost his work, he lost his family was seriously damaged, just all the things that you would think happened. And so sometime not long after that, he and I were thrown together again, and I got to ask him, see him, and he wanted to tell me what had happened. And I said, I want to know this question, this answer. Tell me this answer. So do you remember the moment when the first compromise was made, the first moment when you knew that there was something here that wasn't right that was going on? He said, oh, yeah, I remember it distinctly. Tell me when that was. And he said, well, my wife and I had a number of Christians over one Sunday afternoon for a tea or whatever it was. And as people were departing, this woman was there. And so everybody was saying their goodbyes. And she came up. A lot of people were hugging, Christians hug. But when she hugged me, it was different. And we both knew it. And he said, I can't put my finger on it exactly. But at that moment, we both knew. Well, I don't know all about what was going on, but about what I want to emphasize with you. I mean, I'm another couple right now, it was about the gym. She had a membership of the gym, and so gradually she made compromises. Another one, it's about pornography, gradually made compromise. I had a man tell me the other day, last week, he said, I was addicted so much to pornography that the distance between me and this woman and me and committing adultery was a very short step. I want to ask you this question. How far is the step, would the step be between you right now and committing adultery with somebody? I hope that the step is huge. But if we make incremental compromises, what happens is we get so close that when we finally make the decision to violate the marriage vow, it's a very short step, not a very big step at all. We just incrementally got closer and closer and closer until finally it's committed. Now, Let's begin this way. Why do people commit adultery? Sometimes it's a wake-up call to the spouse. I told you you were spending too much time at work. I never see you anymore. I never do. You're just so very busy. And sometimes it's just too tempting to resist. A few months ago, a marriage broke up. two members of the church, and she suspected that in his truck driving, he would travel long distances, long times apart, that sometimes this was happening. She didn't know it, but finally he confessed it. And she said, "Why? Why would you? How could you do it? Why would you do this to our family, to me and to the kids?" And he said, "Well, it was just too tempting to resist. Reasons why. A friendship gets out of control. It's not so terribly uncommon for me to hear a circumstance when adultery is committed by a couple in the church for it to be that two couples became very close friends. Now, there's nothing wrong with that per se, and I think it could be very healthy. You just have to be careful to appreciate that there are lines and boundaries that we do not compromise, that while you're becoming close friends and good friends, and so you know his wife and he knows your wife and all of that, and y'all become just real buddies, and maybe you'll take a trip together and you just get so close and all that. If you're not careful, what the devil will do is to use that as an opportunity to create compromise because you just feel like you're such close friends. 4, my spouse doesn't live up to my expectations anymore, but this other woman does. The truth is, my wife has good qualities and she has these bad qualities, but not this other woman at work. I know she's always beautiful and she always dresses so nice and she's always at her best, and you have this kind of a romantic kind of thought process that, of course, isn't real. But now shift gears with me. So you can imagine reasons why. What are some reasons why not? Reasons why not. This list is a little bit longer. 1, one of the Ten Commandments. Exodus 20 and 14, very pointed, thou shalt not commit adultery. I want you to bear in mind that God created sexuality. God could have made the human race asexual, couldn't he? Couldn't he have made us able to procreate with one gender? There's no question that he could. Of course he could do that. Why did he do this? And furthermore, and I'm going to be very discreet at the best I can, why did God create sexuality? The world is so crazy about this subject that I think it often forgets that the origin of sexuality is God. So why did God do that? And if you answer procreation, I don't think you're right about that. I understand the role that sexuality plays in procreation, but bear in mind that's a far second to the primary reason for sexuality. The primary reason is to draw husbands and wives closer together. Long time after the childbearing years, husbands and wives still enjoy the intimate relationship in marriage. It's not primarily about childbearing. It's about drawing husbands and wives closer together. But what God did then was to create this biological, this emotional, this psychological draw between a man and his wife. And then he said, now this could be dangerous. If you allowed your eyes to stray, this could be very dangerous. God, now listen closely, is not trying to keep sexuality from us. He's keeping sexuality for us. And in reality, saved his very best for us inside of marriage. And so he builds this wall. He creates two genders and sexuality, and then he builds a wall and says, thou shalt not commit adultery. Now, when you look at Leviticus 20 in verse 10, you have the death penalty attached to adultery. It seems, in our world, our time, it seems so very strong. But I want to remind you that we protect things which we highly value. God is trying to protect us. Always remember that when God says, thou shalt, he's saying, let me show you how to be happy. And when he says, thou shalt not, he's saying, don't hurt yourself. In this case, he said, I'm telling you, you will not, you must not commit adultery. And he put the death penalty. I declare, I doubt there was too much adultery being committed at that time. Here's Romans chapter 7 and verse 2. I call it the first rule of marriage. It goes like this. A woman which has a husband is bound by the law to her husband. Incidentally, that's not the old law, the new law. That's the law of God on marriage. It's applicable to all dispensations. A woman which has a husband is bound by the law to her husband so long as he lives. If her husband be dead, she's loosed from the law of her husband. So then if while her husband lives, she be married to another man, get it now, if while her husband lives, she be married to another man, she should be called an adulteress. But if her husband is dead, she's no adulteress, though she be married to another man. So here's this fundamental principle that adultery violates one man for one woman for life. And here's number next. It constitutes the single exception to the rule of marriage. Now, there is one exception to the rule that I just stated from Romans chapter 7. It's what Jesus said in Matthew chapter 19, verse 9. Whoever shall put away his wife, divorce his wife, except it be for fornication, except it be for that cause. There may be other things involved in this, but the straw that breaks the camel's back is adultery. Whoever puts away his wife, except it be for fornication, and marries another, commits adultery. And whoever marries her, which is put away, commits adultery. Now, it's interesting to me that of all the things that the Lord could have pointed to and said, now this is the exception to the rule. Here's an exception where if this happens, you can remarry and have God's approval. Can you think of things that you might have put in there? I can. Some awful things that sometimes happen in marriage, but that's not the one he put in here. What he put in here was adultery. It's having an affair. That's what he put in and said, under this circumstance, you can divorce your spouse. You're not required to do that. I encourage you not to do that. If you can save the marriage, you ought to save the marriage. You'll be happier if you can save the marriage. But he said, under this circumstance, I give you permission to put away your spouse and marry somebody else, and you will have God's approval still. It is the case in 1 Corinthians 5 for the withdrawal of fellowship. The withdrawal of fellowship in the church, 2 Thessalonians 3:6, is for impenitent sin. Now look, in a body of people called the church, like this congregation, what holds us together is that we share this resolve to live for Jesus Christ. All of us sin, don't we? 1 John chapter 1 says, if a man says he has no sin, he deceives himself. The truth's not in him. We sin. That's just true. We're human and we're fallible and sometimes we're weak. But now, that doesn't mean that we live in deliberate, persistent sin. We've got to agree that we won't do that. Before you became a Christian, when you repented of your sins, that was for a lifetime, and it meant that I can't comfortably live in sin anymore, right? I won't live in sin. I will sin, and then I'm going to make it right, and I'm going to live in that cycle, doing the right. But here's a case where a person is living in sin and isn't going to repent, and you have this case study then for the withdrawal of fellowship in 1 Corinthians 5. What's the case about? It's about having an affair. It's about a man who's having adultery with this woman. Number 6, it is an explicitly damning act. You can't go to heaven like this. So in Galatians chapter 5 and 19 and 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 9 through 11, adultery is included as an act which will keep you out of heaven. Now, I would add this parenthetically onto that. In 1 Corinthians 6, verse 11, he says this. He had cited that some of them had committed adultery, had affairs. He says, such were some of you, but you've been washed and sanctified and justified in the name of the Lord Jesus. That is, a person can repent of that and put that sin away and make things right with God and still go to heaven. Hebrews 13:4 says, marriage is honorable in all, in the bed undefiled. But fornicators and adulterers God will judge. Any ambiguity about that? You see that? I mean, that is just plain how it is. This is serious. Now, why is God so serious about adultery? And the answer, again, is because he's trying to protect us from the pain. I want you to hear me say this and let it go deep into your soul. Based on these passages, it isn't your love that sustains your marriage. It's your marriage that sustains your love. You made a vow before God. I want you to appreciate that when you got married and you signed those papers, you weren't vowing how you would feel in 10 or 15 or 20 years. You can't predict how you're going to feel in the future. You don't know how you're going to feel in the future. That wasn't what you were signing, but you signed a contract, and the contract is about how you'll behave in 15 and 20 years and 30 years and 50 years and 60 years, this is how I'm going to behave. You made a contract called marriage. How do you protect your marriage from adultery? 5 things. Number 1, you must cultivate a great marriage. Remember that feeling follows action. And what I mean by this one is that when you decided to marry, you were crazy about each other and you had these feelings toward each other and you wanted to be together and you didn't want to have to part at night. You wanted to just be together all the time. And you had that feeling, and based on that feeling, you acted. You got married. That's what we did. After you marry, though, I want to suggest that it's very common for us to have to reverse that, or we need to reverse that. And what we have to think is that that action comes first and feeling comes second, that we act in a particular way in anticipation of the feelings. I want to feel close to you. I want to feel happy with you. I want to enjoy looking forward to coming home in the evenings to be with you. But I act in a particular way in order for that to happen. Marriage, good marriage, is hard work. Even if you've been married a long time, good marriage is not accidental. It's something that you work at every day. Two, be the best Christian that you can be. If you want to be a great husband, be the most faithful Christian you can be. If you want to be a great wife, same principle. Now, I think sometimes that we mistakenly, and we wouldn't probably say this, but we have this idea that God has two different laws. They have the general law about how you live as a Christian, you live the Christian life. But then there's sort of a second law about behind the closed doors of matrimony. Well, yeah, well, that's different. He's my husband. He's my husband. That's just my wife. That's different. That's my wife. Is it different? Is it really? I want to ask you the question. So why is it that we would ever feel that the principles of living a faithful Christian life are not really applicable to how we treat our spouse? Are they? Ephesians 4:32. Ready? This is not about marriage, just about being a Christian, right? If you're a Christian, this is bound on you. Be kind one to another, tenderhearted, forgiving one another, even as God for Christ's sake has forgiven you. I want to ask you a question. Are you kind to your spouse? It's not about marriage. That's just about being a Christian. Are you kind? Are you tenderhearted towards your spouse? Or have you developed crabby habits where you just bite at each other all the time? Huh? What about the last part? Forgiving one another, even as God for Christ's sake has forgiven you. How's your forgiver going? I'm going to tell you something. When I was a boy, when I was a teenager, there was this very famous movie called Love Story. And in that movie, there was one famous quote. And it was so famous that teenagers would have posters of this up in their rooms. And the quote was, some of you may remember it, love means never having to say you're sorry. Isn't that the sweetest bit of rubbish you ever heard? Let me tell you something. If you're not good at forgiving, you'll never see the backside of a good marriage. You'll never have a good marriage. You've got to be a good forgiver. About the time you decide that you're not inclined to forgive things, you'll do things that you need forgiveness for. We've got to realize that. How long did it take you to realize that you married a man who's kind of dumb? And he does dumb things sometimes. How long did it take you? Huh? We need to prioritize intimacy. Here's what the Bible says in 1 Corinthians 7:3. Let the husband render to his wife the affection due her. What's the answer to the question about frequency of intimacy in marriage? What's the answer? Does the Bible say anything about that? Yes, but it's not a number. It's a concept. Render to his wife the affection due her, and likewise also the wife to her husband. The wife doesn't have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body. When you married, you forfeited the intimate part of you to your spouse. You don't own that. That spouse owns that. And don't deprive one the other, except for consent with a time, that you may give yourselves to fasting and prayer and come together again, because Satan will tempt you for your lack of self-control. I want to suggest to you that you prioritize intimacy. What you need to have the closeness involved in that, not just physical, but also psychological and spiritual and all things that are bound in that. All right, number two, you need to be afraid of adultery. I want you to create a mental picture. I want you to use your imagination. The Bible talks a lot about using imagination. In Genesis chapter 6, the thought of their imaginations were only evil continually, and God brought the flood. Or when Jesus taught in Matthew 7 and 12, do good unto all, do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. That's how we paraphrase that. How can you practice the golden rule without using your imagination? You imagine how you would like to be treated, and that's how you treat other people. I want you to use your imagination right now with reference to the subject we're discussing. You've got to fear adultery. No pornography. Now, pornography has dealt us a terrible blow in the Lord's church. You probably would not enjoy reading the statistics in our Christian universities of how many boys are addicted to porn. You don't want to know. It will knock your socks off. What happened is that the internet sort of sprang this on us, and you had privacy with accessibility, and now to the degree that there isn't anything that you can't see on the internet. And it drew in our young men, and we have a large number of young men now who cannot function normally in a marriage. They don't discover that till they marry. They think, you know, I've got this porn thing, this habit going on, but once I marry, you know, that'll go away. That's a lie. And it's very destructive even to the beginning of marriage to function normally. No pornography. I had a man come to me recently, and he said, "Brother Colley, I need to have a talk." "Okay, tell me what the problem is." He said, "My wife's put on a few pounds, and it's driven me to pornography." Well, he talked to the wrong fella. I said, "Now, wait a minute, that's not right. You got that backwards, son. What happened is you got involved in pornography, and it made you dissatisfied with your wife. Your wife's got everything that you need, and you just get rid of that pornography." Now, briefly, let me just make this statement. The use of pornography to any degree is a sin against God. It is a sin. So Matthew 5:28 says, here's Jesus from his own lips, "Whoever looks on a woman to lust after her," I do not know how you could better describe pornography than with those words, "whoever looks on a woman to lust after her has committed adultery with her already in his heart." If you're viewing it, and I don't know that because I'm just a visitor, so I don't know anybody that well, but if you are, I want you to just go to prayer right now in your heart. If you're a Christian, you have that access to heaven. And ask God to forgive you and make a vow. I've always known this was sinful, God. I always did. And I just want you to forgive me. And I vow to not do that anymore. And that's good. And he'll forgive you. And then go on with your life. But if you find in a week or two that you're hitting those keys again in the crisis moments. And the crisis moment is when you have privacy, accessibility, and especially when you're feeling really high or you're feeling really low, and the devil he'll just put that pressure on you. And if you find that you're clicking on those sites again, then you have an addiction. It seems a very strong word to use, Brother Colley. Say addiction. Well, yeah, but you made a promise to God and you couldn't keep it. And then what you need to do is to create an accountability system. I've been doing this with men for years and years and years, and the way that I do it is, if you want to get one started, I'll be happy to help you. You find a man who will be your accountability partner, not a friend, not a close friend. A buddy, you'll transgress this. You have to have somebody who you hold in high esteem and you respect, who you'd never like to disappoint, who will agree to be your accountability partner. Then we draw up a contract that makes a sacred vow before God in view of heaven, and because I love my wife and my marriage and I want to be right with God, then I make this vow that I will not deliberately view pornography. And then the way that it works is that the man with the addiction will call the accountability partner every day for a year. On your birthday, on Christmas, on Saturdays and on Sundays, and every day for a year. You know, we usually set it up sometime around noon. That's flexible. And the conversations are short, and we use code language. I pick up the phone several times a day, and a voice, I will recognize the voice, will say, "Glenn, I'm 100%. In code and in the contract, what it says is that since we've last talked, I have not viewed pornography. Great. Have a nice day. Talk to you tomorrow." And sometimes the conversations will go longer. We'll develop a conversation, but very often it's very short, just like that. And what we're doing is building resistance. And after a year, a man will hopefully and typically have built the resistance so that he can handle this himself. And we taper off after that, maybe just 3 times a week for a little while. I have one man with whom I've been doing this for over 5 years. And the reason is that his porn use had so distorted his mind. It has so turned his sense of normalcy that on his honeymoon, he abused his wife. And that's what he'd been watching. And as a result, she went back to her parents. And that's where she has stayed for the last 5 years. When the accountability system with him finished the year, he said, "Glenn, I'm living alone. I can't do this by myself. Can I keep calling you?" "Of course you can." And he's very sincere about wanting to be right with God. I think he's a faithful Christian today. But every, you know, he calls me now about 3 times a week. He's calling me. And "Glenn, I'm 100%. good. All right, let's keep going. Don't give up. Every day, don't give up. No pornography. Number two, don't put yourself in danger. I grew up in a preaching family, and we had the preacher women rules. And I still live with them, and I taught them to my son. And it's very good. Mike Pence, you know, the VP, he came up with these, telling people about his rules, about his wife, and he won't have dinner with another woman if his wife's not there, and won't be in a room, all the different kinds of rules he has. And the left, this was just before the Me Too movement, the left just had a fit about how he had created these rules, and it was unequal, you know, and a woman ought to be treated like a man. And then after that, they thought of the Me Too movement, and now, you know, I don't know what about Mike Pence, but what I thought about it was, wait a minute, that's not new. I grew up with these rules. That the preacher rules about women were that you never counsel a woman alone at your office. You never do. You never counsel a woman in your office with the door closed. Never. If I go to somebody's house, you know, somebody's been visiting our assembly, and I go to a house or an apartment, and I knock, and the wife comes to the door, and she says, oh, I'm so glad to see you. Well, we're just glad that you're coming to worship and wanted to drop by and say hi. Well, come on in. My husband's in Albuquerque right now. I'm not going in that door. I'm not. You know, I'll say, you know what? I just wanted to say thank you for coming, and any questions y'all have, please ask, and just so happy that God bless you. Have a nice night. That's all I wanted, and I'll leave because I'm not going in there. Now, I'm not talking about 85-year-old Sister Jones. You know what I'm talking about. It's the women rules. Now, you look, you find ways to apply those to your own life, and you apply them. If you don't want to fall down, don't walk in slippery places. Remember that adultery for Christians doesn't start in a hotel. Adultery for Christians starts in small compromises. You don't make them. I don't go to lunch alone with a woman. I won't do it. Now, I live in Huntsville, Alabama, and we got a church bunch of engineers, you know, and NASA and all that stuff, and you know, the world doesn't think anything about sending two people on a trip to Albuquerque, and a man and a woman, you know, to do some business. They just spend a week there, and they're in the same hotel. Now, they're not in the same room, of course, but they're the only ones that they know from back home. Can you just imagine how this can happen? You want to have supper? You know what? I don't have anything to do. You want to have supper? Yeah, let's catch supper together. Are you kidding me? You know, what you're doing is putting yourself in a circumstance, a long way from home. And I suppose if I were the devil, I would get that memo and I'd make sure that you had temptation. I'd make sure you did. And suddenly you get closer and closer till the step into adultery is such a very short step. And then you just take that step and you can't reverse that. And you say, we can hide it. I know we can hide it. Can you? You know, it's really interesting about how couples, spouses learn that their spouse is committing adultery. I'm not going to tell you all of them. Some are a little bit embarrassing, but you know, of course, the digital world, and we think that if it's on my cell phone, I can erase that, or my computer, I can erase that, and it won't be found. Oh, wait a minute. You're wrong. There are people out there who know things that we don't know. We normal people don't know about computers. They can find that stuff. One of them was that, this is a little embarrassing, forgive me, but If a man starts buying his own underwear, and I don't get that one really, except that when I first heard that, I thought, I haven't bought underwear in 30 years. I don't know, but that leads to this point, which is that the number one is that we walk in patterns of which we're largely unaware, but our spouses know the pattern. We get used to one another about how we act and think and talk and move and the inflection of our voices. All of those kinds of things are patterns. And the number one in this study that I read was that I just sensed that there was something different. I couldn't put my finger on it at first, but I knew something wasn't right. Something was different. Don't you think that's interesting? And you suppose you can hide that? You suppose you can? Go ahead and give that a try. Go ahead. Number next, keep your closest friendships of the same sex. Now, again, we're talking about friendships, and I think it's fine. We're in the church, and we have sisters and brothers in Christ, and we're friends, and all of that is so very healthy and good. But I'm talking about your close friends, your closest friends. You be very careful about that. Women are different from men in friendships, and I think that one way is that they require more of an emotional attachment to a friend than a man does. And that can be very risky. We don't need to be having intimate, private, personal conversations ongoing with members of the opposite sex. Be protective. This is number four. Be protective of your marriage. All right, now I'm going to make a rule for you if you'll accept it. And the rule is this. Very simple. For those of you who are teenagers, not married yet, someday, hopefully somebody will have you. We'll see. But when you marry, I want you to practice this. So everybody in this room that's married, I want you to practice this. Anytime you're with a member of the opposite sex and something is said or something is done that makes you feel uncomfortable in the context of this discussion, it may be that the other person really doesn't mean anything at all by it, but it just doesn't feel right, doesn't sound right. I want you to always say something of a positive nature about your spouse right then. That's what you do. I was riding on an elevator in a hospital, big old tall hospital, got on the ground floor, and this woman got on at the same time, first floor, and we were riding up together in this hospital. And I knew the hospital elevator rules, don't talk, you know, riding up the elevator, listening to music. And directly she said, you smell good. She was right about that. I did. She was right. But it made me feel ill at ease. And I said, well, thank you. You know, my wife gave me that aftershave. That's her favorite aftershave. And the woman said, well, isn't that nice? Now, I'm not suggesting that the woman had anything unseemly in mind, but it made me uncomfortable. And so we get to the top, the elevator doors open. Have a nice day. Have a nice day. Two things happen. One is that had she meant anything unseemly in that, I tell you, we poured cold water all over that, didn't we? But in the second place, that night when I pillowed my head to sleep beside Mrs. Colley, I didn't have to wonder if I had done anything that was transgressing of my marriage. I didn't do anything that would even compromise anything about my marriage. Whenever you're with a member of the opposite sex and something is said or something is done that makes you feel ill at ease in the context of what I'm describing, always right then say something of a positive nature about your spouse. Number five, test your heart often. Here's what I mean. Are you sharing more feelings and thoughts with your friend than with your spouse? Well, you don't understand. He's one of my coworkers, and I don't know. There's just something about him. You know, he's just so easy to talk to. And so sometimes I have problems or struggles, and so I talk to him because I can just be open with him. And I feel, frankly, I feel just comfortable with him, and so I don't do that. Wait a minute, don't do that. What's happening is dangerous. No, you don't understand. So I when I see her at work, we're coworkers, and I just like to be around her. She's just so easy to talk to. And we kind of developed this, well, you know, we take our breaks together because we have to. And so we sit and we just talk. And I kind of look forward to that because I can just open up to her and she's so understanding. And wait a minute, do you know you're standing on quicksand? Do you understand that you're in a dangerous spot right now? Run from that. Be careful about that. Two, what about sexual tension? You understand what I mean by this. And I don't really have to describe it for you to know it when you are in this, where there's just something you think, you know, tomorrow when I go to work, and I keep using the illustration of work because so often adultery occurs because of work-related relationships. That's not the only place, but often is. And you think, oh, tomorrow. Now, you wouldn't say this with your mouth, but you think tomorrow, you know, I'll get to see her again. That perfume she's been wearing, really good. And that sweater, I wonder if she'll wear the red sweater. I like that red sweater. Wait a minute. What are you doing? What are you doing in your thought processes? Don't you understand that this is so very dangerous? This is wrong. You got to stop that. What you're doing is closing this gap. Don't let this go. You've got to back off of that. Get away from that, because what's about to happen is that you're going to get closer and closer. You could be doing something. I had a man last week the week before called, and he hadn't committed adultery, but his wife had discovered that he was addicted to pornography. You know how that works. He goes out and he's cutting the grass. This is how it happens. He's going out, leaves his laptop on the kitchen table, and his wife comes in, and she forgot to plug hers in, and so hers is all out of electricity. And she thinks, I'll just Google something on his computer, and she pops it open, and there's a picture. There's a naked woman on there, and she can't breathe, and she hits history, and it's full of it. It's just full of it. And the trust of that marriage just explodes. He said his wife had just discovered this about him. He was eat up with it. That's what we say in Alabama. He was eat up with it. And he said, the truth is, Glenn, that if a woman had offered to be with me, I would have said yes. You know what? He's about that close. That's how it works. That's how the devil does it. You compromise incrementally with little compromises until you get to where you're so close that it's just not a very big step at all. It's an easy step. What about secrecy? The secrecy works this way. When your husband comes around the corner in the house and you're on your laptop and you just ease the lid shut. Oh, there's nothing really on there that would be bad, of course. But I wouldn't like to answer a lot of questions. He doesn't really understand this relationship that my friend and I have together. So she doesn't get this, whatever. Close the lid, right? Or you're on your cell phone and you see your spouse coming and you hit something so that it just changes. Get that away because, you know what? You're in dangerous waters right now. That's a very serious thing. If you are doing anything besides your Christmas shopping that you don't want your spouse to know about, you're in risky business, buddy. You're in risky, risky business. Proverbs 5 and verse 8 says, remove your way far from her and do not go near the door of her house. All right, number next. You want to save yourself from the adultery that will destroy marriage. Affair-proof your marriage. You got to communicate. Now, this one seems simple, but I think it's something you have to work at and deliberately work at. I knew a man one time who would set up a listening chair. He'd set it up in the bedroom, not by the bed, but on the other side of the room. And in the evening, before they turned in, before they disrobed, he would sit down in this listening chair, and he would say, honey, tell me about your day. Tell me all about your day. Tell me what happened. And just listen. Just listen and talk about it. I think it's good to reciprocate that. Tell me about your day. And just talk. Now, quickly, there are five different levels of communication. This is very important to appreciate because of the top one, the number five. The first one is the frivolous level of communication. And we do this in Alabama. I live kind of in the country, Mrs. Collie and I do. And when you get out 6 o'clock, 6:30 in the morning, and you're driving on those long stretches, why, you'll pass someone, sometimes in a pickup truck, and you drape your, this is how you do it in case you want to know, you drape your hand over the steering wheel, and as you pass, you do this. That's the frivolous level of communication. But I want to tell you, there's a whole paragraph in that. And it says, I don't know you, but I acknowledge you as a human being. And I care, therefore, about you, and I really hope you have a great day. That's what that means. Boop, just like that. It's the frivolous level of communication. Two, the factual level of communication. Now, this is what you do with a coworker or a schoolmate where you say, is it A, B, C, or D? No, it's E and F. Ah, got it, thanks. That's very important communication, but that's factual level. Up from that, you come to fellowship level. We did that at lunch today, where you sit and you talk. Brian and I sat next to one another and we just chatted. And what happens is you exchange ideas. Well, one time when I was over here, I did this. Oh, that's interesting. I did something similar to that. And you know how that is. That's a wonderful form of communication and Christians need it. We need to eat together. People sometimes, where I come from, they fret about whether it's all right for the church to have a place to eat in the building. I see the authority for that in a generic way in Galatians chapter 6 and verse 1, where the Bible says that we ought to bear one another's burdens. And universally, people do that while they're eating. It's the fellowship level of communication, right? But up from there comes the friendship level. The friendship level is what you might assume. We open up more. We talk more. We may say things to a friend. We do, don't we? That are a little more personal that we wouldn't, because I trust you, you're my friend, and we wouldn't say to other people. Now, I said all that to get to this. The top one is the freedom level of communication. It's what you must have between your husband and wife. The freedom level of communication is not the freedom to hurt you. That's not it, or to abuse you or exploit you. But the freedom level is where she's my wife, and there's nothing that I can't say to her. I can tell her about my dreams, my desires, my fears, my concerns. There's things I'm wondering about that I couldn't talk to anybody else about that, but my wife, I could. It's that freedom, and you understand what I mean by that. If you're married, you understand that. But now what will diminish that is when we don't treat each other right. When I say to my spouse, well, I know this may sound silly, but I have this dream that someday I'd really love to do this. And the spouse says, I think that's stupid. I doubt that you're going to talk about dreams anymore. with your spouse. If you're abraded or abused, you're just not going to do it. You're going to stay down at the friendship level, and you'll have a good, mediocre marriage, but you're never going to have a great marriage, because a great marriage involves this intimate freedom level of communication that involves a great deal of trust. Number four, you need to share a hobby. When you decided to marry and when you were first married, you had everything in common, or so you thought, and you did lots of stuff together, and you liked all the same things, and that's why you fell in love with each other, and then you married. What happens is that if we're not careful and we don't work at this, we start drifting apart. And it's so very gradual, but often comes around, and he has his hobbies, and I have my hobbies, and it's with different people. It's okay with me if a husband and wife have a different hobby. Maybe he likes to build engines and she likes to do oil painting, and those are very different things. Provided that you and your wife, you and your husband, share a major hobby that you love to do together. What do you love to do? What is it that you enjoy doing together? And if the answer is, well, I can't really think of anything, you better find it. Find something and deliberately start doing it that the two of you enjoy doing. To Mrs. Colley and I, we're on the road a great deal, and so we always have a book going. I don't care about the radio, but I like for her to read to me. So we have biographies, and we have fiction and nonfiction, and she always has a collection of books. She's buying along. She sees something that she thinks we'll enjoy, so she buys it, and we read, and so we talk about the plots. And I'll say, oh, you know what, Sandy? I know what's about to happen. Don't say it. Don't say it, she'll say. Oh, you're always right. Don't say it. Don't. Oh, no, I smell it coming. I think it's coming. Oh, no, don't say it. What do you like to do? You like to go out to eat? Do you like antiques? Do you like to maybe running or sports, some sort of sport thing that you enjoy? Find something that the two of you enjoy doing together. What this is about is drawing closer together instead of farther apart. If your hobbies are exclusively apart, then what's happening is that you don't even realize it, but you're incrementally becoming undone. You want to keep your marriage from adultery? Use your imagination. This is my last point. You want to affair-proof your marriage? Use your imagination. I want you to imagine this reality that, you know, John 8:44 says the devil's a liar and he's the father of lies. I don't know where that principle is more applicable than in the one we're talking about right now. Adultery make a great liar out of you. You'll be a chronic liar. But there's a big lie in this too, and it's this, that you can trust that person with whom you're having the affair. I think that's, if you don't mind, I find that's humorous. It's so foolish, it's humorous. Here's a person, and if this person's married, so he is willing to violate his marriage vow to be with you, and you're willing to violate your marriage vow to be with him, but there's some level on which you expect there's going to be some loyalty here. Well, from where? Are you kidding me? From where? I mean, both of you are just a couple of liars. You're lying to God, you're lying to each other, you're lying to, you know, you just, it's just not. Marriage cannot survive without loyalty, but lust and adultery can't survive with loyalty. You hear what I'm saying? I want you to use your imagination. Suppose this thing goes south. It's already south. But suppose you decide that you want to repent and be a Christian and do right by your husband or your wife. And so you break it off. Well, that's what you should do. If you want to go to heaven, that's what you'll do. But that doesn't mean that your adulterous friend is going to go along with that. Just walk, oh, I understand. I'm glad that you want to be a good person. So farewell. I'll pray for you and you pray for me. Is that, you know what? what it's apt to be is you can't do this to me. You know what? I love you and you can't do this to me. The point is that you'll have given the other person great power. I will tell your spouse, if you do this to me and you hurt me this way, I will tell her. Really? Or you love your kids, don't you? You want them to find out about this? Then go ahead and leave me. I'm telling you, I will tell them. I will tell them. Really? Your employer. I'm just telling you that you're giving this other person great power. A person who you say, well, I know I can, because he loves me. He loves me. He loves me. Really? That's pretty impressive, you know. He's a man who would break up your marriage, but he's really a loyal man. He's really, oh, you just don't know him like I know him. I reckon I know something about him. I know that he's a disloyal person. And I know he's capable of this, or he wouldn't be, lady, with you. Right? And the irony is that you're going to wake up one morning Go ahead and dissolve your marriage if you want to marry this man. But you're going to wake up one morning and you're going to be laying in that bed looking at the ceiling and thinking, what a terrible mess I've made of my life. What a terrible thing I've done. And now my first love is married to somebody else. I can't fix this. I can't go back and have that life again. I can't because I blew it on stupidity. You'll become a chronic liar. You can't be like a CIA agent. You can't just come home in the evening and talk about everything you've done that day. You can't. Because you might, you know, you got to parse your words. You may say something that would provoke some sort of question that you can't answer because it might reveal something, and more questions you can't. So you think carefully about explaining who you've been with or who you've talked to during that day. You'll have to face your children. A man told me one day who was leaving his wife for another woman, members of the church, years ago, he said, Glenn, I said, what about your son, your five-year-old son? What are you doing to him? He said, I have friends who have divorced and married someone else. And he said, what they tell me is that children are very resilient. It's not uncommon in cases like this where the one who's committed the adultery says to the other spouse, I think you better tell the children. In which case, very often the innocent one will say, oh, no, no, let me explain this. You're going to tell the children because you're the one who committed the adultery. You're the one who found somebody else. You're going to tell the children. And go ahead, use your imagination and picture the faces of your children as you explain this to them. See if you can do that. And if that doesn't just tear you all to pieces, then there's something matter with you because you'll destroy them. You take adults who come from broken homes, and some of you probably do. I don't know that. But adults who came from broken homes live with that the rest of their lives. There's something in them that hurts for the rest of their lives. And you'll have trouble with God because God has made such explicit, specific, plain talk about this and the wickedness of violating your marriage vow. You've been very kind to listen, and I appreciate your time so very much. And I hope that this will be beneficial to you. And it may be that you'll have someone who you feel needs this recording and will benefit by listening to it. And I hope you will use it that way. I wonder if there's someone here this afternoon who needs to make life right with God, need to become a Christian, haven't done that, need to be baptized into Christ, or need to be restored to be faithful and to walk with God. We're so happy to help you however we can. We're going to sing a song of encouragement. If you'd like to respond, come as we stand and sing.